welcome to Outward for the month of September. I'm Brian Lauder, editor of Outward, and I'm happy to announce that we are finally, officially, in goddamn decorative gourd season, bitches. So get festive.
Okay, as you wish. I'm Christina Cotterucci, a staff writer at Slate and host of The Waves, Slate's podcast about women and gender. And I'm currently calculating how much cleavage is too much cleavage for this family-friendly women's pro soccer game I'm going to this weekend. I'm taking input. And we have a very special guest host with us this month, Ruman Alam. Hi, Ruman.
Hi, how are you? Good. I'm Ruman Alam. I'm a novelist. I'm one of the Care and Feeding columnists for Slate.
Such a great column.
And it might be decorative gourd season for you, but to me, it's back to school season. So that's what I'm dealing with at the moment.
You are also a parent. Yeah. Yes, that is true. So not so festive in your household.
Well, actually pretty festive. I mean, I almost wept with joy when the kids went back to school, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm sure that's exciting.
Congrats to them and
thank
to you.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, some quiet time. Well, that's wonderful. So with the change of seasons, we thought we'd freshen up our format a little bit. It occurred to us, looking back over the year that the podcast has existed now, that there are only so many big themes in the world, and we had used, I think, all of them, or almost all of them. So we decided to move the sort of format of the show to looking at big stories in queer life that are happening sort of around when we record and sort of in the discourse each month and talk about those and then see what bigger discussions we can pull out of them. So it's pretty simple. Hope y'all all like it. This month, we're going to think through the big report from August about research into gay genes, and then we'll tackle the news that McCrae Game, previously a big proponent of conversion therapy, now disavows the practice and has affirmed his identity as a gay man.
Yeah, so I guess we kind of do have a theme, which is looking at how people determine if they're gay.
It's true.
Or how people
yes.
believe that people become gay. But before we get into that discussion, we're going to kick things off with our September prides and provocations. Ruman, as our new third, why don't you start us off?
Yeah, I am sort of a temperamentally provoked person, but I wanted
join the club.
To. I
wanted to right in.
I wanted to begin on a positive note, so I'm going to talk about pride. And this year, my family vacation, we spent 12 days on Fire Island,
nice.
Which is a little enclave not far from New York City. And
Cherry Grove or Pines?
We were in Cherry Grove, uh-huh. And it is sort of like historically more of a lesbian community, but it's pretty mixed. And you know, there's this old joke about somebody saying to a gay person on the street, like, there should be an island for you guys, mm-hmm. and the response being, well, there is, it's called Manhattan. But the truth is that that island for gay people is actually Fire Island, and I am a novelist, I don't have a job, I send my kids to public school in Brownstone, Brooklyn. Like, I have a very comfortable out life, and so I never think of myself as needing a place to be among my people. Mm-hmm. And it was funny to be there and realize how powerful it can be to actually be surrounded by gayness. And it was especially affecting to me this time to see so many elderly gay people. Mm-hmm. That was one of my favorite things about this trip, because we were there, you know, over the weekdays when the party crowd is kind of on the weekends, and then over the weekdays you see a lot of older people who have owned homes out there for a long time. And there's something great about seeing just the previous generation of gay and lesbians still out there having their getaway from it mm-hmm. all.
Yeah.
Had you been there before?
I have. We've been going there for, gosh, since before we had kids, but it's quite
oh,
a different
wow.
experience now to go there with the
with
children,
kids, yeah.
you know? And it's just such a, it's such a beautiful place. It's so relaxed. It's so non-judgmental.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so diverse in this strange way. It's just all different kinds of bodies, all different kinds of people
yeah.
mixing. And it's sort of idyllic, mm-hmm. you know, and you go to the grocery store that's run by this Sikh couple from Long Island and spend $11 on a package of hot dogs. And it's yeah. just like, what could be better? What could be better as a vacation? And I think it's very powerful for my kids to see that also, to see that there are so many varieties of family. We live in
yeah.
one specific, you know, variation of family, but we're not the only people who are defining what family is for ourselves. And I think it's affecting to see that.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Yeah. Brian, what about you?
Well, I have a similar one, actually. So I just got back, I guess, 2 weeks ago now from New Orleans. I had gone, and Christina, you were there too, for a lesbian and gay LGBT journalism conference. But it also happened to be Southern Decadence, which is a big annual sort of Mardi Gras style party for queer people in New Orleans that I've never been to.
Sure, it was a total coincidence that the Queer Journalist Convention was there.
The scheduling may have been thoughtful on their part, on the organization's part. I truly didn't know about it when I, like, you know, scheduled the trip and then found out later that they were at the same time, which was great. But a sort of similar pride there to you, Ramon. I had never been to a thing like this where queer people, you know, we have our bars and our clubs and our sort of traditional establishments that we get to congregate in. And in New Orleans during this time, it's just like a huge street event. So people are at those places, but they're also just out everywhere. And there are just so many queer people. I think it's like 300,000 or 400,000, something like that, queer people come in to New Orleans for this.
Wow.
It's nuts. And, you know, it has all the beauty of people partying and being sexy together and sort of having that kind of thing, but also being defiant. I encountered at one part of Bourbon Street at a certain point a group of anti-gay, like religious folks who were protesting decadence and, you know, Westboro Baptist style, like screaming with signs and all that. And our family was out there, you know, twerking in front of them and making out in front of them and doing all that stuff, which was really gorgeous. So Southern Decadence is amazing. I highly recommend it. And I really hope it becomes a part of my annual life because it was really beautiful, especially in the South, to see something like that going on.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Christina, what about you?
I am both proud and provoked this month by the same thing. I can hold two things in my head at once. So last night, at the time we're recording this, last night there was the third Democratic presidential debate, which I watched and covered for Slate.
Ugh, you're a brave woman.
It was a lot, but I enjoyed it. And one bit that really stood out to me was at the end where the moderators kind of gave the candidates lean to just spill a little deets about themselves. You know, what was a personal setback or a professional setback you encountered in your life? And Pete Buttigieg, the only gay person on the stage, talked about coming out and doing so, you know, after serving in the military during Don't Ask, Don't Tell, serving as mayor in a state where Mike Pence, you know, arguably the most prominent anti-gay person in America, mm-hmm. was governor. And it was somewhat moving to me as a queer person to see a gay person on the stage talking about coming out when, you know, just a little more than a decade ago, I remember in 2007, there was a presidential forum on LGBTQ issues during the Democratic primary that year. And two people didn't even go. Joe Biden and Chris Dodd didn't even show up to the forum. Mm-hmm. Only two people on the stage even said that they would support equal marriage, and they were Dennis Kucinich and Mike Gravel, who were sort of like the joke candidates or like the long shot candidates. To now, there's not only is there no one on the stage who would even dare come out against any LGBTQ rights, but there's an actual gay man talking about the calculations he had to make as a closeted guy in the military and in politics. It was incredible. And
but what provoked you about that, though?
Great question. So he didn't say the word gay. Mm. If you were just sort of half listening at home, you wouldn't even necessarily know what he was talking about, you know, and especially if you didn't already know he was gay. It was just about like acknowledging who I was and like mentioned Don't Ask, Don't Tell. It's a small thing because it's not like he's hiding that he's gay, obviously. Like, you know, he's very much an out candidate. But you got the sense that these were pre-written statements because it was a very open-ended question. It wasn't like, you know, they had sprung something completely out of left field at the candidates and they had to think on their feet. The question was, you know, what was a personal or maybe professional setback in your life, which is, you know, they could pretty much pull any anecdote from their stump speech. So in this instance, it was a little strange. The reason why I was proud and provoked was it felt like we were simultaneously breaking new ground for queer people on the national stage and also transported back a generation to where you could talk about being gay as long as you didn't outright say gay.
Like the word, yeah.
That is the Buttigieg candidacy in a nutshell, I think.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So I'm sitting with both feelings right now.
Hold space for that. I think that's fine.
But very glad that it happened. And I thought it was great that he took that as a moment to talk about it when, you know, he certainly could have talked about anything else in his life. Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
So on that note, Brian, want to take us into our first topic?
Yes, I do, Christina. So last month, the journal Science published the largest ever genomic study designed to explore the origins of human sexual orientation. It looked at the genetic data and self-reported sexual histories of about 500,000 people and provided the most substantial evidence yet that while there is not a single gay gene, there does seem to be some fairly weak genetic basis for same-sex behavior spread over a few spots in the human genome. This news precipitated a flurry of coverage and discussion about where queerness comes from, of course. So we're going to talk about the implications of all of that today. I will say we're not going to get into like the scientific weeds of the study because that's not good for podcasting. but if you want to read more about it, and I think it's really interesting, I suggest you read evolutionary biologist and fellow gay Jeremy Yoder's piece in Outward called A New Age of Gay Genomics is Here. Are We Ready for the Consequences? And we'll definitely put that on the show page. So to start us off, I feel like, you know, we all probably have our own internal belief or mythology about where our queerness comes from. Some mix of, you know, whether it's nature or nurture or essentialism and constructionism, like there are all these words for it. But I think we all kind of walk around with a sense of that for ourselves. So I'd love to hear from you guys, like how you characterize yours in the past and then what this news did to shift that or change it or if at all.
I mean, speaking for myself, I rarely think of any aspect of my life as being determined by genes, although obviously many of them are. You know, the fact that you write with your right hand or the fact that you are a certain height or whatever. But it's just so removed from my self concept. And so it's striking to read. I mean, of course, there are many people who do this for a living and think about this for a living. And science to me is like ancient Greek or something, sort of, you know, meaningless. And I, not only did I look at the reporting around this study, I looked at the Broad Institute's. They have a sort of part of their website where several people at the Institute talk about the study and the methodology. And when I read about sort of scientific methodology, again, it's just sort of mind-blowing to me the way that they conducted this study, drawing on reporting from 23andMe and this sort of database of all white people, all, you know, Western or European people.
And the UK, I think,
And so it's just the way that we extrapolate what we accept as fact from these various particular sets of circumstances, that's how science is done. And it's weird for people who are not scientists, I think, to confront that and to think about, oh, this is how science is done and this is how we end up with vaccines or, you know, all, a whole slate of other, you know, advances in society. So, again, it just feels very removed from me, even though obviously it's not.
For me, I've always felt that my queer identity is so much more than just like biological sexual attraction, which when I think about a genetic or biological basis for sexuality, I think of it in terms of physicality. So what do you find attractive? Who do you want to have sex with? And for me, it's so much more than that. And sexual attraction and interest is just one part of it. You know, I think in a society that was totally gender equal, like perhaps I would have been more like on the pansexual spectrum, especially considering that I've been attracted to like very feminine men and very masculine women. Like, gender and gender presentation and attraction to me is so non-binary that to think about a gene turning on or off, you know, telling me who I'd like to sleep with, it doesn't really square with the way I conceive of my sexuality, especially because sexuality isn't just about sex in terms of identity. I mean, it's about power and relationships and sociality. It's a lifestyle, which I know I just sort of laughed at in the previous segment, but it, like, for me, it is. Even if you don't hang out with other queer people, which for me, a lot of it is about, like, the society that I find myself in and the communities I surround myself with. What about you, Brian?
So I've thought a lot about this because it's kind of part of my job to think a lot about it. And I'm writing about it in my book, and it's just in the air for me a little bit more. And I think I've come to this weird, like, in between place, between sort of a social view, a constructionist view, if you like, of, like, where identity comes from. Christina, you were just talking about, like, how much of gayness or queerness is sort of about where we live and who we hang out with and, like, our politics and, like, all of that stuff, which can't be genetic, right? Even some of these, the terms that we use to describe ourselves can't be found genetically. You're never going to find pansexuality. Probably is not something you would find in genes. It's something that is a as much a political commitment as it is anything else, or a statement rather. However, I also watch home videos of myself as, like, a 3-year-old, and I look like a big queen. So, like, clearly there's something there. Like, something there's something deeper than just something that you encounter culturally later in life. I think there has to be, you know, something there about attraction, probably, for sure, and, like, what, you know, smells and pheromones and all that stuff that you find, like, arousing in a very basic way. But also there's something about about gender expression too that I don't think we've quite found yet, but that feels true to me. And I just, you know, I see that those videos of myself, and I also see kids, you know, around the city walking with their parents. I'm like, yep, that's a gay. Like you can just see it. I assume it. You know, I could be wrong, but, like, that is, it does strike me as being something that exists.
And then, when you think about that, if you, you know, take that kid 10 years down the line, you know, in another world, the very feminine kid who isn't being bullied or being told that they're gay or whatever, like, could grow up to be a very feminine straight man.
Totally.
Probably not very often in this world, but in another one with different social influences, possibly.
I mean, the study's own finding that genetic effects likely account for about 32% of whether someone will have same-sex sex is so specific that it seems to answer something, but it actually doesn't. Because what, you know, what accounts for that other 68%? Is it whether you went to Smith College or the University of Arizona? I mean, it doesn't really, it's not, it's like you're saying, Brian, so much of this stuff we counter with our anecdotal observations about ourselves or about, you know, other people in our lives. And it is just, it's the kind of thing that I feel a genetic study or a scientific study can never really get at. It's too big. Or maybe, you know, maybe a century from now, science will have an answer about all of this stuff.
I think that's a good sort of segue into what I wanted to ask about next, which was, you know, to the study's credit, it does differentiate between sexual, like, behavior and identity. The authors make a point of saying we're not talking about, you know, gay, lesbian, LGBT. We're talking about, like, whether a person says they have had same-sex sex, like, in their life, and how that correlates. But the authors do that, but, like, our own sort of born this way ideology or discourse that's been so prominent among the community for a couple of decades now, at least, doesn't do a good job of that. And we clearly want there to be a gay gene, or a lot of us do. It seems like that's a desire that a lot of people have. So I was curious if y'all have thoughts about why that is. Like, why do we, some of us, seek certainty, an origin story for ourselves? What's the appeal?
I mean, like, the obvious answer to that is that it would, you know, one would hope, force some people, like the people we'll talk about in our next segment, to realize, like, I can't change this person. They clearly are, you know, quote unquote, born this way. If it's biologically based, that means maybe God did it. And if God makes people that way, who are we to say that God is wrong? But I also think there might be some comfort in knowing for sure, especially for people for whom you know, being gay has been a struggle, mm-hmm. or who maybe don't feel at home in LGBTQ spaces but still want to be or are gay, identify as gay, like maybe it could be some comfort to say like, okay, I definitely know that this is who I am, or it's not who I am.
Right. They want a diagnosis.
Right.
Yeah. Mm. But even that 32% figure doesn't, you know, it just doesn't account for all of these slippery cases where, you know, if you have had same sex sex, you can identify as a whole host of things.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
I mean, we all went to college, you know, like,
yeah, like I drunk.
Know, yeah, like I know that from experience. And that, it just affirms, I think, that human sexuality is so complicated and so hard to reduce to, I mean, never forget about binary. We're talking mm-hmm. about like a much larger system than binary. And it's still, there are still not slots to fit every person or every case mm-hmm. study.
Right. Right.
It made me think of this question that the Washington Blade, which is our gay newspaper here, they do a series called Query, where they ask an LGBTQ person 20 boilerplate questions about their lives. And up until this April, for the past probably decade that they've been doing it, one of the questions was, if science discovered a way to change sexual orientation, what would you do? Mm. And you know, people, some of the answers were something like, I would protest it, or like, I would question why they science wanted to do that, or, you know, I would stay gay. I've struggled so hard to be accepted, and now it's made me into this great person today. One person answered, I would ask for it in pill form because there are a number of straight people I'd like to give it to. So if you're able to find a genetic basis for sexual orientation, or you know, even if you're able to identify these genetic factors that could contribute to your ability to be gay or something, you know, it also opens the possibility of straight people accessing genetic editing to turn themselves more likely to be gay. I thought of this book that came out in January called How to Date Men When You Hate Men, which is kind of a strain of heterosexual feminism that I both sympathize with and detest. But I do wonder whether there are any women who might have been political lesbians back in the day when that was more of a thing, would want to try to just genetically open themselves up to being gay, or, you know, and possibly there are some men who would want to do that too, but I can see less of a market for that. But yeah, that's, I think, the worst case scenario to a study like this, or to future studies, which of course there will be future studies, is then people extrapolating that or taking that information into some sort of conversion, mm-hmm. like biological conversion therapy treatment.
Well, there was a dissent quoted in the Times reporting, and I read it was done as a blog post by a fellow at the Broad Institute, which conducted the study. And this man, Joseph Vitti, wrote, a polygenic risk score for non-heterosexual behavior could easily be used to hurt queer people, mm-hmm. regardless of its limited or lack of predictive value. As scientists, we should not be making it available for misuse. So I think that there was like an ethical component where people within the institute that conducted this research were concerned about what you're talking about, which is not the ability for straight people to turn themselves gay, but in fact, the inverse, you know?
Right.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm glad you brought that up, because our writer as well, that wrote the piece for Outward that I mentioned earlier, brought this up too, that you know, even though the results of this study showed, again, like a pretty weak correlation, that it would be entirely possible to develop a bad test, mm-hmm. But a test nonetheless, for embryonic screening from it. And he actually worries that someone will try to do this in the marketplace, and that parents who, you know, don't want gay kids, queer kids, would begin using it to screen their fetuses or their
Which
embryos.
Is crazy, because I think we can all agree that having a gay kid is like best case scenario.
Well, see, you're a parent, so I actually wanted to ask you, like, as a parent, like, how do you react to that notion?
Because you know, that's just, I don't even think you have to be a parent to feel mm-hmm. sort of icked out by that weird Gattaca way of thinking about, you know, the panoply of the human race is just like, it's a beautiful thing, and tinkering with it to enforce some arbitrary standard of, you know, tall is better than shorter, you know, thin is better than fat, is very distressing. And even though I think what the study is showing is that that's most unlikely to happen, mm-hmm. It is still an ethical concern. I mean, clearly this, the person I quoted before or the person who wrote the Slate reporting, these are people who know. They're geneticists, and they understand the implications of the research that's being done. And it's worrisome. And I'm glad that we have ethicists grappling with this stuff.
I feel like I was about to ask you guys if you want further research in this vein, but the sense I'm getting is no, or that you're not super interested in it. And that's,
well, would you want to take this? Would you, you know, if you did 23andMe, because now you can do that. When
right.
you take these tests, you can say, do I have these sort of genetic factors?
I feel a lot of tension actually around this because I am like super pro science generally. I like believe in the power of science to like make the world a better place and, mm-hmm. and to explain, you know, I watch Nova on PBS. I'm into science and like want science to happen and basic science just for curiosity's sake as well, not just like, you know, useful to the capitalist market kind of science. But in this case, I find myself not wanting it to continue. Like, I just really feel defensive is an interesting word, uncomfortable, fearful, just like it's not a good idea, guys. Like, could we just stop?
It reminded me of a similar controversy that happened around advancements in cochlear implants and belief among deaf people, certain parts of the deaf community, that deafness is a culture or that it's not a disability to be fixed, but that it is sort of a way of approaching life, and that curing it, I'm making air quotes, is not of interest to them. And I think it's a similar ethical challenge. Yeah. And I don't think the science is suggesting anything curative. I mean, it's still a long way off from there. But I think that's what we're all concerned about.
Well, that's what we think about all this. But we would love to hear what our listeners think about this very complex topic. So please email us at outwardpodcast@slate.com.
All right. Our next topic for this month is McRae Game. He's a gay man who founded and ran one of the country's most prominent conversion therapy organizations, Hope for Wholeness, formerly Truth Ministry. He ran it for 20 years. And late last month, the Charleston Post and Courier ran a big feature on him. So McRae taught people that if you gave in to your queer desires, you were going to hell. He says multiple clients of his attempted suicide. And he says he was never, quote unquote, cured of being gay. He was first sent to conversion therapy by his parents before starting his own organization. But he says he never believed you could be, quote unquote, cured. He always felt attractions to men. He says he struggled with porn. But he believed and he taught that you should never act on those queer desires. So he got married. He had two kids. He and his wife are still together, by the way. But he was fired from Hope for Wholeness in 2017. And he came out after that. Now he's fully embracing his gay identity. He has disavowed the entire institution of conversion therapy because it causes so much harm. He's wearing a tank top in his Facebook picture. His profile image is surrounded by a rainbow border. He's posting topless selfie videos after his workouts. He's flirting with men in his Facebook comments. It seems like he's really, you know, doing pretty well. He seems like he's really found a way to now embrace his gay identity in a cultural way in addition to a sexual way. So that's great. But I will say it's always a challenge for me in situations like these where I know he himself has gone through so much emotional pain and struggle, but he's also caused so much pain. So I'm very emotionally conflicted every time I read a story like this, and this is far from the only story like this. You know, several people who have led conversion therapy practices have come out and said, you know what, that didn't work. I did a lot of harm, and guess what? I'm still gay. How do you guys react when you read about this kind of thing?
Well, I just want to cite The Onion's reporting on this story, which the headline for which was "Apologetic Conversion Therapy Founder Offers to Electrocute Past Patients Back into Being Gay."
Oh, my God.
I think that particular treatment of humor and darkness sort of says it all. I think I listened to an interview with McRae Game that Christina had recommended to me, and it made me feel very, very sad. It made me feel deeply sad, and I think it is a sad story, a tragic story, and I'm glad that he's come out, and I, as somebody who has not, like, ever been affected by the evils of conversion therapy or the sort of monolithic church in this country, I'm lucky to be able to say that. And I think there are many, many gay and lesbian people in this country who will feel differently.
Yeah.
And I do not blame them.
Yeah, I would like to be able to feel only sad, because I think that's the most graceful approach to something like this. I mean, he's what a horror to have lived his life, put yourself through that kind of bizarre, from my point of view, torture. However, as someone who grew up in South Carolina, actually, where he is based, and around, not in like the evangelical church, but definitely around the church, the sort of big American church, like the way you just put it, I have anger too. I have a hard time forgiving or overlooking all the pain that Christina just described, because it's real, and it doesn't, you know, you can ask for forgiveness, you can sort of wish to atone, but you know, lives have been lost according to him, and untold, you know, emotional pain has been done to people. Therapy bills are expensive, like, if nothing else. Like, it's just, it's serious. And I don't know. Let's put it this way. I would have a hard time seeing him walk into my local gay bar in his new tank top and feel like that was chill. I'll put it that way. Yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking about the question of, you know, whether I would, or whether we should, welcome people like this into our queer communities with open arms. I mean, on the one hand, trauma, and you never know how trauma is going to affect someone. On the other hand, it also makes me angry to see him saying things like, you know, most LGBTQ people have been ridiculously kind to me. You know, sometimes I'll get angry messages when I'm on my gay dating app, but for the most part, people are really nice. I get so angry, like, and I know I'm not proud of this. I don't think it's the right response, but I'm almost like, you don't deserve to wear that boy brief bathing suit yet. You know, like, give the culture a little time. Give these communities a little time from when you decided, okay, now I'm gay, to when you expect to be fully welcomed into the community. And you know, it's funny that I know I keep mentioning all these like outward ways that he's telegraphing his gay identity. And I was trying to unpack, like, why does that make me so mad? Mm-hmm. And I think it's because people are beaten up for wearing those kinds of things in public.
By
people who are empowered by what he has been doing for the past 20 years. You know, they see this man who says, I'm gay and I just choose not to act on it, and anyone could do the same, and who's married and has kids with his wife, and they will look at their own kids or other people in their community. And, you know, people who are out and proud and wearing their earrings and having their rainbow Facebook profile pictures and saying, well, if this guy could do it, McCray Game, for 20 years, why can't you?
I mean, I think if nothing else, this sort of gives the lie to the larger evangelical project in such a damning way. Mm. He himself describes gay and lesbian people as the lepers of the world. And you know, Jesus did not say, like, take the lepers and, like, electrocute them until they were cured. Yes. That was not Jesus's teaching. And, you know, I feel for him as an individual, because you can't help but feel that he was enacting something much larger, much bigger than him. It was distilled down into his personal mission, mm-hmm. or his personal ministry, but it was being conducted by the forces, like the sort of like really craven American political forces that, you know, say, oh, we should, you know, well, this will be the issue in the culture war, and we will empower a small set of people to take over the church. I mean, it's just the irony is so nuts. Like, this is the exact inverse of what Jesus said. And we'll let them do that for the sake of advancing a very specific political agenda. And it's so it's so sad, and it's so, you know, Christina, I share your sense that I would, you know, it's sort of like maddening to see him embrace all of these things that really cause real harm to real people. But and to be able to get away with it and celebrate it. But he just, it feels like the problem is not really him.
Yeah, you're right.
That's so impressive of you. I'm serious. I really am sitting here feeling challenged by that because I think it is easy. Anger at something like this is pretty easy. But seeing it the way you just described as sort of a structural problem that he's just enacting is I think true and hard. I mean, speaking to Christina, just your point about like why the signifiers were so upsetting to you, I'll just add to that quickly that like the other thing that makes that hard to swallow is that means he was like paying attention to those signifiers while he was doing this. Like you don't just know what the cute swimsuit you said was. he's been like he was plugged. He was like somehow observing queer culture, gay culture, even while he was doing this. And so that is tough. But again, what a weird, crazy place to live, you know, mentally for him. So I'm going to try to adopt Ramon's like benevolence because I think it's healthy.
I want to mention one other strain of conversation I saw around this news, which was a lot of people, including a lot of straight people, saying things like, well, there's another one, or like, of course, you know, is anyone surprised? Which I totally get. Like, yeah, obviously somebody who's the head of a gay conversion therapy organization and used to, quote unquote, identify as gay or whatever, like, of course it's not a surprise when they come out. But it also feeds into something that I've seen even around people like Mike Pence, where people will be like, oh, I bet he's closeted. Or like, you know, only a gay person could be so homophobic. Or like, this is evidence of some sort of repressed desire that he has. And I find that extremely objectionable, too. And I almost feel myself starting to get protective, or like it's not until
of
I
Mike
see
Pence.
People saying not of Mike Pence, but about people who then do come out as gay. So there was another I forget who it was, another a big name religious leader recently came out as gay, you know, after having preached against gay people for decades and decades. Again, a common story, but it wasn't until I saw straight people saying like, you know, here's another one of these that I started feeling like, well, hold on a second.
Right.
Like this, right. It's homophobia is not gay people's problem.
Yeah.
There's certainly plenty of internalized homophobia. Gay people can be complicit in homophobia and enact homophobia clearly. But I don't want to get to a place where we're saying there's a connection between LGBT identity and causing LGBT people harm.
Well, it like reinscribes this weird like armchair psychoanalytic thing about like gayness or queerness somehow being tied up with repression or like weird like unsalutary like psychic, you know, structures or something. That's a bizarre sentence.
But that was a great phrase.
But you know what I mean? Like there's something essentially like pathological like on some level about queerness, and so it produces people like this. Like that's, I think that's like a strange subtext there, even as the people that you're, the straight folks that you're talking about are ostensibly like supportive of the existence of queer people. It's like weirdly taking part in this old like Freudian thing from you know that we've abandoned. So that is that is strange. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that McRae Game himself would have said even, you know, earlier before he came out that, you know, it's hair splitting. But what they're talking about really is choosing not to act on what's termed gay impulse. So basically what they're saying is that you can be gay, you know, as determined by God or gene, whatever, and you can choose otherwise.
Yeah.
And in coming out, essentially what he's saying is that he's choosing otherwise. He's choosing to get laid effectively. And, you know, that is... So that makes the whole thing kind of weirdly sordid.
Mm-hmm.
Like it just reinforces that it's about sex and not about all this other stuff that's baked into it. And I share your sense, Christina, that it's really irritating to hear this described as a sort of a repressive instinct, as though you can't just be a jerk who hates gay people for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And also because the repressed part isn't coming from within. It's coming from external forces.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so in this podcast that you mentioned, Ruman, McRae went on the podcast of a friend of his, a minister named Charlie Venzel. I will say it was a pretty calm conversation considering that Charlie, just sort of says outright, like, I do think that acting on gay desires is a sin, but, let's hear each other out. And he also said it would be good if this conversion therapy actually worked because there are so many people distraught over this that they kill themselves over it.
Yeah.
So his perspective is that the cure for LGBTQ people hating themselves isn't in the faith tradition or the culture that made them hate themselves, but in changing the nature of those LGBTQ people.
That's right.
And for me, that's the hardest part of this because it tells me that as long as there is homophobia in families and in communities and in our sort of national rhetoric, there will be a market for something like conversion therapy or for taking, some sort of a study on gay genes and trying to apply that to changing somebody's nature. Even though McRae says, he doesn't think that being gay is necessarily biological, but he also believes that it's not something you can change through therapy or even should change through therapy. He thinks that now. But it's just this opening in the marketplace that is waiting to be filled, and there will be LGBTQ people who want to fill it and pay to have this sort of therapy as long as they are being oppressed and, from forces outside themselves.
I have to say, I think that that interview with Charlie Venzel was really interesting. And one of the most, it was very reasoned, it was very calm, and one of the most striking things to me was that Venzel himself talked about the leaders of the church, and I'm using church in a really broad sense here, obsess over homosexuality. Mm-hmm. And that just shows us that, as you're saying, Christina, this is like a marketplace question. Mm-hmm. This is that people with power have determined this to be a problem because they can monetize it and they can harness a indignation, a sort of sense of moral panic around this to accomplish other things. It's precisely what you see around pro-life conversations in this country.
Yeah.
It's being harnessed by political forces, and there are real human costs inside of that. And that's why I guess I heard that and just felt so sorry for this man, because it was this feeling that he was just this tiny player inside a much bigger fight.
Listeners, we would love to hear what you think about this story. You can email us at outwardpodcast@slate.com. And, would you slide into the DMs of a former conversion therapy practitioner? We'd love to hear it.
Okay, so that's about it for this month. But before we go, it's time for our usual updates to the gay agenda. Christina, what do you have for us?
I'm recommending an article in Atlas Obscura by Reina Gattuso. Mm. It's called "The Founder of America's Earliest Lesbian Bar Was Deported for Obscenity." That's the headline, and it's a really good summary of the article. There's just so much great, rich world building and history in this piece. It starts out as just a really interesting history of this woman, Eve Adams, who was the proprietor of Eve Adams Tea Room in the West Village in New York. It opened in 1925. It was a hangout for queers and particularly women, and also for Jewish intellectuals who were shunned from other establishments at the time. There was a sign outside, apparently, that said, "Men are admitted but not welcome." Kind of a joke, but probably a little bit serious.
Mm-hmm.
So Eve just seems like this incredible butch. There are some great photos in the piece. She hung out with Anais Nin and Emma Goldman. She hosted people at this bar. She published lesbian short stories. And then she ended up getting arrested in a sting operation by an undercover NYPD officer, a woman, who, it sounds like, kind of seduced Adams. And then when she got to Adams' bedroom, took this copy of a lesbian story collection and used it as evidence to arrest and deport Eve Adams. And it's a terrible ending to the story. She was eventually killed at Auschwitz.
Jesus.
But it's the story of this beautiful life and also cruelty beyond measure. And it made me think a lot about how the homophobia and transphobia is intersecting with the human rights violations currently being committed at the U.S. border. You know, trans people being held in gender inappropriate detention facilities, being denied health care, surviving rape, ICE separating HIV-positive parents from their children. And many of these people are fleeing persecution back home, too. So I loved this piece because it felt very current to me and also just was a very clear-eyed view of a woman who I had never heard of before, but is incredibly interesting to me. And I'm really excited to learn more about her.
Yeah, where is the biopic?
Yeah.
I know, seriously.
Yeah, it sounds like it, yeah.
And who would I cast is the question. Again, the title of it is The Founder of America's Earliest Lesbian Bar Was Deported for Obscenity, an Atlas Obscura.
That sounds fantastic, Christina. Thank you. Yeah. Ramon.
This fall, the National Book Foundation is going to give its 2019 Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters to the writer Edmund White.
Mm.
And the previous recipients of this very significant award include John Ashbery, Maxine Hong Kingston, Stephen King, Judy Blume. And hearing this, I was really reminded that Edmund White was a huge figure to me when I was a younger person. I read his novel, A Boy's Own Story, furtively at the age of 16 or 17, and I haven't read it in the years since. People talk about it as kind of a gay catcher in the rye, which I think doesn't really speak to the level of White's writing. He's a beautiful, elegant writer. He's had a huge and very prolific career. He wrote a biography of Genet, and I know many gay writers of my generation consider him a mentor. And so this fall, I'm going to reread A Boy's Own Story, which I have not read for, you know, 24 years. And just preparing for this, just glancing back at it, I realized that the book was published in 1982, which is when GRID, now known as AIDS, was first identified. And there's something very striking about that to me, that White chronicled his own generation of gay men, I think he's in his 70s, just before the ensuing generation was really decimated. And we don't have a lot of texts like this, and it's striking to see the author of one really be welcomed into the firmament of, you know, American literary history. Yeah. So I think it's very exciting, and I'm excited for him, and I'm excited to revisit that book.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds excellent.
Super well-deserved.
Brian, what do you have?
Well, you guys are so, like, serious. Mine's mine's serious, too. No, it's good. So last night, I went to a concert of the wonderfully queer artist Mika. Do we know Mika?
Oh, yeah.
Like
Mika? That's kind of a throwback.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's a throwback because he's actually kind of been away for a while. People might remember the
Love
Lollipop
today,
song.
Love Today.
Love Today. Today. Yeah. There were some bops back then. Like, God, I feel like in, like, college. So that's kind of what I think is in a lot of people's heads. And he has been sort of away from recording and touring for a while. This is the first tour, I believe, in 6 years, something like that. So he's back, and he's got a new album called My Name is Michael Holbrook, that's coming out in October. There's some singles out now, one called Ice Cream that's wonderful. But I just
love that he has an ice cream song and a lollipop song now.
Yeah, yeah. Also lots of song about colors. The show is structured around colors, which was lovely. Ooh. If people aren't familiar with him, or if you haven't listened in a while, go check it out. Get your Spotify up or whatever and listen. He's got the spirit of Freddie Mercury inside of him. It's like insane to watch this person who just has this kind of fey muscularity down that, like, that I attribute to Freddie, or to like an Elton John or someone like that. But it's new, it's fresh in him, it's beautiful. He has like a composer's sort of musical sensibility. He's done orchestral albums, and the music really stands up to that. And he's also adorable. I'm a little bit in love. Has this beautiful floppy hair. By the end of the concert, he was like soaking wet, which was great. go listen to the music, listen to the old music, listen to the new music as it comes out. And the show, it's called the Tiny Love Tour. If it comes near you, definitely go. I am serious that this is certainly the best, like, queer concert I've ever been to, and also the best concert I've ever been to.
Wow, really?
He holds a room, man. It's like, it's nuts. So get there. Mika is amazing.
You've convinced me. That's our show. Thank you so much for listening. Please keep sending us your feedback and your topic ideas. You can reach us at outwardpodcast@slate.com or via Facebook and Twitter at Slate Outward. Also, if there's ever any advice you need about anything in your queer life, send it our way. We might read your question on the show. Ramon, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. What a pleasure.
Thank you also to Melissa Kaplan, who provided production assistance for this episode. Our producer is Daniel Schrader. Love you, Daniel. June Thomas, the senior managing producer of Slate Podcasts, is what made us gay. If you like Outward, please subscribe in your podcast app, tell your friends about it, rate and review the show so other people can find it. We'll be back in your feeds on October 16th. Bye, Ramon.
Bye.
Bye, Brian.
See ya, Christina.
Stay gay, everyone. Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.